Razi, also known as Sharif Razi, was a reserved scholar and historian who played a crucial role in compiling the sermons, letters, and sayings of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, into the book Peak of Eloquence. His dedication to preserving the teachings and wisdom of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, has ensured that future generations have access to the profound insights and spiritual guidance found within Nahjul Balagha. All of this is presented to you in the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio.
Now, when you talk about a person should be busy or should their times should be occupied, it doesn't mean the type of stereotypes we have in our minds regarding a person who is busy. Oh, he's so busy he doesn't have time for his relatives and friends. Oh, he's so busy he doesn't have time to study. Oh, he's so busy he doesn't have time to worship. No. Mashghulun waqtuhu means he is busy doing his duties. Duties means that he has time for his family, he has time for his relatives, he has time for work, he has time for worship, he has time for everything. And his time is filled with obedience of God. So, obedience of God is not such a, such a clearly painted thing that a person thinks that it has to be, you have to be maybe holding your hands in a certain way, or maybe bowing down in a certain way to be in a state of obedience. No. Obedience means being in a state of, worship, and obedience just means that you are doing what Allah says, which includes all of these actions. And of course, those interested can refer to the narrations that we have and the statements of our ulama and our scholars on how we should fill our times properly so as to be obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar.
حين دعاه نال ما Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. We are very glad to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Inventions that emerge from the Islamic world include the discovery of Critic acid, Jaber ibn Hayyan, architecture, the minaret, the bridge mill, the vertical axle windmill, teaching hospitals, marching bands, early torpedoes, the guitar, the lute, the water pipe, also known as hookah, early attempts at gliding, algebra, the pinhole camera, the laws of refraction of light in optic, coffee, and more. Muslim scholar Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes, Kepler, and Isaac Newton. You are listening to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start this hour's lineup with A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. They will be followed by our varied radio productions feature. And we finish off this hour's programs with Muslim Lady, the quintessential radio program for Muslim women. The program deals with a variety of subjects in relation to Muslim women. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I Am Being English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously respect for others is one of the fundamental things that we need to, to some extent, it would come almost automatically to us. And at the same time, I think it's a trait that maybe many of us still can actually train even more. And look, there's some very beautiful examples about this. So respect for others can actually also mean that we are sort of more open to others. And I'll try and explain this, because obviously it's one thing just being respectful by, let's say, holding open the door, greeting people and saying thank you, these sorts of, let's say, things that are related also to courtesy. But there are higher levels to this. For example, one of the famous martyrs from Holy Defense, Dr. Mustafa Chamran, so it's said of him that, you know, he often came across people who maybe didn't share his viewpoints, maybe were coming from a very different direction, sort of politically, almost totally opposed to Dr. Mustafa Chamran's ideas. But look, Dr. Chamran would sort of take the positive from it, because for him, it was really useful learning the viewpoints of others, because he could then, through dealing with people who are maybe very opposed and maybe even at times almost verbally aggressive towards them, very difficult to deal with, he could then in himself develop even more traits of sort of patience and respect for the others, in a sense. So this is a different way of looking at it. Welcome back to A to Z here on I Am Being English Radio. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that when people are really difficult to deal with, it actually also helps us to sort of just be more patient, develop this idea of maybe even being more compassionate, being calm, and sort of also maybe just sort of focusing on maybe not even always the tone with what that they're using, but also just sort of honing in on, okay, well, what's the actual content of what they're saying? Is there something in there that's really, really useful that, you know, we need to respond to? And we also, immediately also think back to the idea, it's one of the famous examples from Islamic history, obviously our Holy Prophet. And we know that even before the beginning of sort of wars, for example, the very famous Battle of the Trench, the Holy Prophet would typically consult with, you know, his companions as to, you know, what to do and the best strategy. And so obviously this also is just exemplifies this idea of listening to the others, hearing the different viewpoints. And obviously when the Holy Prophet realized, oh, this is a very good idea, obviously, for example, Salman Farsi suggesting the idea to build the trench. And obviously, so listening to other people's viewpoints is very useful and sometimes brings us the sort of really good strategy for going ahead. And obviously, this is, and we see this in all the martyrs. So whether these are the martyrs of the Holy Defense or even martyrs of service, for example, of national service, for example, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So he too, it was very important for him to sort of hear different viewpoints. Even if his colleagues, if other officials had very different viewpoints, he would also take these on board. So I think these are qualities that we can maybe hone in ourselves as well, inshallah. So I pray that you've gained some benefit from today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on I Am Being English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Radio.
Fabian Zuleg, the Chief Executive Officer of the European Policy Centre, based here in Brussels, one of the most prestigious think tanks in the EU. Thank you very much for your time. I know you're a very busy man with a big team. In relation to the State of the Union 2025 address this week from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, it was the first time we've heard her speak tough about Israel. And she talked about the possibility of sanctions against ministers and so on, and suspending parts of the trade agreement. Why do you think her stance on this subject has changed?
Well, there has been an accumulation of different things. Certainly, there has been a lot of pressure on her. But I think what is also very significant is that the opinion has been shifting at the domestic level. And in some of the big countries, the leaders were becoming more critical of Israel. So, in a sense, she has tried to catch up with where the debate overall was at that moment in time. But, of course, there are still big divisions within Europe. Different countries have very different takes. So she also acknowledged that some people will think she's not going far enough, and some people will think she's gone too far.
Why do you think it is that we do see so much division in the EU on the subject of Israel?
I think we have to look at two dimensions. I mean, firstly, it is normal that there are these divisions. We have 27 different countries which have very different foreign policy stances, and we shouldn't forget that foreign policy is not one of the main areas of European coordination. Every country has their own policy and has also differing opinions on particularly issues which are as intractable as the Middle East, where for a very long time there hasn't really been a convincing solution on the table. But the other element, and that also has to do with how the European Union is set up, even those countries which might agree with the Commission President or with other parts of the European institutions very often object to the European Union becoming involved in these discussions because they don't see that this is a role for the European level to have a foreign policy stance.
Yeah, but we see the EU is now preparing its 19th round of sanctions, tough sanctions against Russia, and yet no sanctions so far against Israel. Like, why do you think that is? Is it the argument that, you know, Ukraine is in Europe, or is it the fact some people talk about the very powerful Israel lobby that has an influence over the decisions that are taken here?
I would actually argue that Russia is the exception. It normally is difficult to get agreement between the member states when it comes to foreign policy issues. Just having seen, for example, the incursion into Polish airspace very much highlights that this is something which affects all of us. So in that area, it is much, much easier to get consensus to move forward. Yes, there will be one or two countries which object, one or two governments which object, because they always object. But in principle, there's a vast majority which supports that action. When it comes to Israel, when it comes to other parts of the world, there are far greater divisions. In part, that also has to do with history and the specific history of some countries with the countries involved. But more generally, it's just more difficult to get agreement, as we also see, for example, when it comes to China.
Well, the day before Ursula von der Leyen delivered the State of the Union address, there was a debate in the European Parliament on the situation in Gaza. And what you see there is a big chunk of the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, the EU lawmakers, they are very far right. They support Netanyahu. They're very far right in their views. Why do you think it is that we're seeing the rise of the far right in the EU?
It is a long-term trend. We have seen the far right strengthening over time. In many ways, these are anti-parties. They don't really have solutions, they don't have programs, but they know what they're against, which is also a feature of how democratic discourse is developing. It's much easier now on social media to just simply be against certain issues and to get coalitions together which can block things. I think what we have seen in the United States is also a phenomenon over here, and we shouldn't underestimate how much the developments in the States will also fuel some of those divisions within Europe. Clearly, there are a number of far-right organizations which refer to Trump, which think that the Trumpian agenda is exactly what is needed. And I think we are going to see that it very much mixes with some of the big topics. I mean, clearly migration has always been one of the breeding grounds for the far right. But we're also seeing increasingly it's about climate change and the measures which are there. It is about the war and supporting Ukraine. Very often couched in terms of even if this is something which needs to be done, we shouldn't be the ones who are paying for it.
And Fabian, another thing that Ursula von der Leyen mentioned in her State of the Union address is in relation to the cost of living crisis. I mean, prices are so high here in the EU for rents, for food. You know, we've just seen a massive price increase over the last few years. Do you think, we mentioned the far right earlier, do you think that is why that could lead to a further expansion and rise of the far right?
I mean, certainly we live in much more challenging times. That's economically, that's socially. We are now in a period where for the first time really in European integration history, there's a realistic chance that the next generations are going to be worse off than current ones. And that creates a lot of political problems. In many areas, we now have to distribute costs. It's not about the benefits from working together, but it's actually about saying, how do we pay for defense? How do we pay for the green transition? How do we pay for all the different areas where we need to invest in the next few years? So it's a much more difficult political environment. And yes, many people are feeling that their life is getting worse, that they are not as secure, as stable, that they see prices rising. But the difficulty is that many of these are trends which are beyond the control of our governments or of the European Union. And the right-wing populists promise a lot, but there is no way they can fulfill these promises. And it's interesting, we've seen it with the example of Brexit, we've seen it now starting with the example of Trump. These promises do not lead to better outcomes for their population. In fact, they lead to worse outcomes, but it's very hard to counter them before they get into power.
Can I ask you as well about EU-US relations? Because obviously there's been a lot of tensions on issues like trade since Trump came back to the White House. How would you assess at the moment? There are differences on foreign policy. There are obviously issues in relation to trade. And what else could happen, we don't know. But how would you assess relations at the moment between the United States and the European Union?
Relations between, I would say, the White House and the European Union are very bad. In many ways, Trump is opposed to the concept of the European Union. He doesn't like multilateralism. He doesn't like cooperation between states. He believes in a world where power matters. And if you are stronger, you can do whatever you want. He doesn't care about allies. He cares about who he sees as important people. So it is about people like Putin, and it is about those who fawn over him, who suggest that he will get the Nobel Prize, and so on. So this is anathema to how Europe works. It is a real threat to our democracy, because of course there are influences of that on our debates on our parties. But in the background is always this dependence of Europe on security as well. And that's why we also had to accept a deal, which is a very bad deal for Europe, but there were only bad choices on the table.
And when you say a bad deal for Europe, do you think that the European Commission, the institutions, the EU leaders could have pushed back harder against Trump on this issue?
Of course, we had the choice to push back harder. The question is, what would the consequences be of that? And we have already seen that Trump is very willing to put security on the table as well. And that is a risk which Europe at the moment cannot run because we are too dependent on the United States and Ukraine is too dependent on the United States. So what we had to accept in the end comes directly out of our weakness.
Can we afford more military spending in the European Union? We do have, if you look at the Eurostat data, we have a huge number of people at risk of poverty or in poverty. We've had, you know, increased spending in NATO, and most of the NATO members are also members of the EU in terms of the countries. And then additionally, more military spending within the EU itself. So billions upon billions being spent on weapons, and people argue not enough on social justice. So can we afford all this military spending?
I think we don't have a choice. There are imperatives which we have to fulfill, and defense has to be one of the key areas which we spend money on. And it is an area where also you will need a lot of public money. It is not something where you can rely on the private sector. But then I think it is also a question of seeing what is it actually we are spending on. There is a lot of money in the 5% target, which is also about infrastructure. It's about developing what will also help the private economy. It's not only about military. I would also argue that we can benefit a lot from this additional spending in the defense sector if we think about it in the right way, if we coordinate in Europe, if we don't buy all of these weapons from elsewhere. I think there are many things which we can do. But in the end, it's also not only about amounts of money. It's not about the figure which we are going to put in the end to convince Trump that we have done what we said we would do. It's about how well we are spending it. And I think this is the biggest challenge we have in Europe. When we look at how much we collectively spend, it is vastly more than Russia. But we are not very effective in how we spend it. So we need to find ways of getting better at spending that money, and that also means doing more things together. One of the big challenges, and I think that goes right through the State of the Union in almost every policy area, is that we now live in a world where the need to work together at the European level is greater than ever. Many of the challenges will not be addressed unless we do it together. But the political reluctance to really work together, to put competences at the European level, is greater than ever. So we have a paradox.
Can I ask you as well, you know, one of the big policy achievements of the European Union was to create the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA nuclear deal with Iran. And Trump in his first term tore that up. Now we don't know where we stand in terms of diplomacy and nuclear talks with Iran. Is there any hope of resurrecting the JCPOA in your opinion, or creating a new accord? What are your feelings, or what are your thoughts on that?
Certainly, the deal with Iran was groundbreaking, and it was very much Europeans in the driving seat, working out what could be done. But it was already very much damaged. After Trump tore it up in his first presidency. And now with the attacks on Iran by Israel, it's very hard to see also what the Iranian side is going to do. Clearly, there was a decision taken, I would argue, not only in Israel, but also in Washington, that military force would be more effective. Now it remains to be seen whether that's true, whether this has really damaged Iranian capabilities in the long run. It has increased the volatility, but we can't just go back to the old deal. That time has passed forever.
And in your view, could the EU side have done more to save the JCPOA nuclear accord? Could they be doing more now diplomatically in terms of trying to secure a new agreement?
It seems to be that at this moment in time, some of the key actors within the Middle East are entirely ignoring Europe. So if the United States, if Israel do not listen, it's very hard to see how Europe could play a broker role, because clearly you would have to have also concessions from those countries. So at the moment, I think it is very difficult to see any way forward. And I would actually argue that what we have seen over the last month is a significant deterioration in the Middle East, which will destabilize for a long time to come, because even long-standing issues like the two-state solution for Palestine is looking even further away than it did before.
Do you think there's any hope of a two-state solution at this stage?
At this stage, no. At this stage, there is no willingness to even start negotiating. But I would also say that all the actions which are being taken now are running counter to the idea of a two-state solution. So it's very hard to see how we will even return to the status quo before all of these attacks.
Yeah. And do you think that, like, even with the recent attack on Qatar, an independent sovereign state, and we saw the attack by Israel on Iran, and the United States also attacking Iran, but in terms of Israel's position, do you feel there's a move away from Israel in the EU, given that we've seen an escalation and attacks on sovereign countries? I know he has Benjamin Netanyahu and the government have a lot of support, for example, in the European Parliament with the far right, but generally speaking, at government level, EU institution level, is there a move away from Netanyahu?
I think what we've seen also in the reaction to the bombing in Qatar is that this is breaking the kind of guardrails which for many countries are just a step too far. Will that change his behavior? Well, that really depends on the big supporter. It depends on the United States. And there the question is whether, yes, we've seen a bit of condemnation, but whether that condemnation will actually be followed with concrete steps or whether it simply is talk. Unfortunately, my guess would be that Trump is not willing to do anything decisive, which means that Benjamin Netanyahu will just continue doing what he's doing.
More generally speaking, Fabian, can I ask you about what you see the future of the European Union being? I mean, the euro area is expanding shortly. In January, Bulgaria will join the euro. There are many countries that want to join the European Union, full stop, and they'll automatically join the euro in that case. But is there a danger that the EU could expand too quickly to bring in countries that might turn against the project in the long run, as we might have seen here at the moment, for example, perhaps with Hungary and a couple of others? So in terms of the future of the EU, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we should be very careful that we're not nostalgic about the European Union and what it might have been in the past. Because the reality is that we are seeing challenges also in the member states which were there from the beginning. What will happen, for example, if we have a far-right French president, which I would say is a very realistic possibility at this moment in time. We see that far-right parties, anti-European parties, are strong in the polls in Germany. So this is something where I think we have to be very careful not to to paint a too idealistic picture of what the current EU is like. We have to bring in the countries which are waiting. Enlargement should not be something which is even in question, because the geopolitics, the geoeconomics mean that we have to bring these in. If we do not bring in Ukraine, it will not be safe, which has implications for all of us. If we do not bring in the Western Balkans, other countries will step in and will dominate politics there. So we have to do it, but what we have to do at the same time is also make the reforms necessary to make a union function with 30-plus members. And that's where we didn't see anything in the State of the Union. There was no realistic idea of how do we actually move from the union as it is now to the one which we need to have to address the challenges, including also bringing in the countries which are waiting to come in.
And is that a failure in terms of her vision, Ursula von der Leyen's vision, or is she just merely peddling the views of and the feelings and the stance of the EU leaders and the EU institutions, or is it a personal failure in terms of having the foresight on her part?
I would argue both. Yes, she is reflecting where the debate is on enlargement and reform, but it is also a question of her not putting forward a stronger vision, not putting forward concrete steps to say this is what we should be doing next. But clearly, the blame does not only lie with the Commission President or with the institutions. The key question here is how willing are our governments to do the policy changes which are necessary to address the fundamental challenges which we all have, but which are difficult and at times politically costly.
Fabian Zuleg, CEO of the European Policy Centre, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service. And in here, I have a very dear friend, Sister Nasreen. And I would love her to introduce herself at the very beginning of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum, Sister, and welcome.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for inviting me here so that you could listen to my opinion. allow me to give my opinion and my ideas. I don't know what you want me to say. I'm from England and I live here. Mm-hmm. And I'm always ready to discuss Islamic issues.
Very good. That's all what we need in here in Muslim Lady, which is all related to the concerns of ladies from all around the world. So wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is just so okay with you. We're going to be talking about beauty surgeries and all these pressures that come from the industries like fashion, like even, again, media. And they're creating this image of a woman as a doll. And then every woman feels like, okay, I have to be like this perfect picture. And if not, I'm not a perfect woman.
Well, you know, right at the end there, it's like, what is a perfect woman? Women have to understand that it's not your career. It's not your education. It's not your looks. It is what you build in yourself as a human being. And the confidence that you gain from that, it's not the confidence, like the West says, have confidence and that's attractive. But where does that confidence come from? Some people show it on the outside. A woman is not going to be looked down at when she's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an attractive woman. To a woman who's real, you know?
Yeah.
It's not about the looks, because there's unattractive women getting very attractive men. Because men see through it, you know?
Yeah.
The number of men in their 20s that have asked me to marry them, and I'm like, I'm not your mother. They don't like young women because they're superficial. They don't like superficial people. This is off air, right?
It's a different perspective. I think nowadays everybody is so superficial, mostly.
Yes,
not everybody.
But where the woman goes, society will follow.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
We have
to
turn it around.
Look at the women of a society, of a nation, and then define that nation.
Yeah, so it's not the men's fault.
No, it's not.
It's the women's fault.
Unfortunately. But you can look at, you can read it differently as well. Like,
how?
Women are what men want them to be.
No.
Yes,
you cannot change a woman, but you can change a man. If a woman's going to be whatever she wants to be, you cannot. Imam Ali said it. You're going
to
break her rib.
Why she wants to be this way?
Because of deception.
Okay, that deception.
Okay, so change the
deception that I have. That okay, if I look like
this. Change the perception.
That's the job of the schools. Because right now what I'm saying...
The school has to change it? That's a mother's job.
Education.
What is education?
If the mother is like the entire society, so where can I learn that from? When a mother is just like the other parts of society, me as a girl, where am I going to learn these things that, okay, you should look deep down, not outside?
Well, that's a problem. You're by saying, where am I going to learn it from? That's already looking outside. We have everything. It's, you see, the education of the soul and the heart and perception is all in the practices of Islam. You may say that the Islam has every answer. We automatically, in our minds, picture books,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's not what Allah said. Allah says, Ikra, recite. When you recite the Quran, what you're doing is you're feeding your heart with everything it needs, right? You're connecting to Allah and He is speaking to you. He's giving you the wisdom, right? Wal Quran al Hakim. You can't get wisdom anywhere else, only from Allah. When you get the wisdom and then you go to the book, of course you go through the alphabet first, then that knowledge becomes the imams, because you've connected to them, they translate it, which is called interpretation, to you as you understand it in your life. You see, Islam is spiritual, but spiritual is not a strange phenomenon that's out there.
So
it's a reality.
Just a gist to what we were talking about in today's episode. We are talking about the confidence that a woman gets, and then you were just saying
how to build it.
Yeah, how to build it, and you said that because previously we talked about beauty and all these surgeries and whatever that we see around in societies right now. You said that it shouldn't come from the inner, from the outer beauty. It must come from somewhere deep down.
Yeah.
And
so
then
in
you
order
said that
for it to come, you have to feed it. How do you feed it? Vibrations feed the heart. The sound of Quran, the recitation of the Quran, because listening, it feeds your heart, but you're not creating. In order to create, you have to give the breath, right? And to feed the brain, you have to write what you're reciting. So, but most importantly, after that, it doesn't stop there. You have to you have to feed the heart and the basira, the third eye, with the names of Allah, to put those names into your soul. You know, you have to feed Allah's names, not one here and one there, and give me wealth and the, you know, those things that give me knowledge, give me wealth, give me the law of chemistry, all of them. And it's very simple. I just pass on one very simple practice: 15 minutes a day, 33 names, and 33 names, and 33 names, right, every 15 minutes, every day. You finish 99 names in 3 days. I speak to a lot of them on Facebook, on this media, that media, this group. Nobody's doing it right.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
By the way, you're back to Muslim Lady, and we're still covering the discussion of confidence. And suddenly, out of confidence, not suddenly, actually, through a course of discussion, we got into this point that, okay, you have to have that link of connection with your Lord, and that comes with recitation of dhikr and all of the names of God. But I was saying that there are many women out there. I know them and I respect them. But the thing is, they say something.
There are many.
They act paradoxically. Like, imagine our neighbor. I'm just, this is a thought, like hypothesis.
Yes.
We have a neighbor. She's very attractive, and I'm very much of a child. I'm attracted to her, and I know that she prays. She does everything that a Muslim woman must do.
How do you
but
know?
When she comes out of home,
how do you know she does?
She is totally different from what I've been raised upon.
No, how do you know she's doing all the things?
I've seen her.
You've seen her. You can't see this. You can't see a system. You can see odd behaviors. But unless someone talks about it, you won't know.
So, I would
some
say
people
my assumption
show on
and
the
tell
outside
me if I'm wrong.
Something.
You mean that saying is not enough?
No, I'm not saying
they
that.
Must
I'm
be
saying
believing
that there is
that.
No way to know the practice of a person unless you analyze their issues with what are they doing, questioning
them.
Let
me
you
make
know?
It more realistic.
Yeah.
I have many friends. And this is my question, actually. I have many friends. Mm. They're very kind-hearted. They're very cool people. they are very confident and they are not practicing hijab. And at the same time, we've been to mosques together, we've been doing the acts of worship together, and then I come to this paradoxical
point. You just mentioned two
point.
Things that are performance.
Okay, they're performing that.
Performance.
So
that's a performance Islam. That's not a spiritual Islam, and that's
so
the problem.
So what it does not affect them? Why?
Because it's performance. It's not feeding the soul. That is exactly what my point is. That we have reached a performance religion. You cannot analyze, for example, one brother said to me, my nephew, for example, his nephew was not practicing Islam, they're leaving. He said, but their parents are praying and fasting. I said, but that's not the point. The Holy Prophet himself said, don't look at the way a person prays or fasts. Look at the way he treats a human being. Okay, it is slightly off the subject here because we need to understand the spirit, right? Listen, imagine a human being, right? He's reading,
mm-hmm.
right? That's nafs. The brain is connected to the nafs, right? Imam Reza alayhi salam
said
this.
Is nafs the same as the soul?
Nope. No.
Spirit?
That's why I have to use the Arabic. Otherwise, we'll get confused.
Yeah.
Imam Reza alayhi salam, and this was a translation,
mm-hmm.
so I have to use his words. He said, the heart is more important than the brain because the brain is connected to the nafs, but the heart is connected to the ruh. So that's why I was explaining in our previous program that in order to connect the ruh to Allah, to feed it, you have to use the nafas,
the breath. Yeah.
In reciting cyclically, completely, holistically, comprehensively the names of Allah.
Yeah.
Daily. Because it's scientific too. When you recite something repetitively,
it becomes a part of you.
It releases serotonin from your pineal gland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only a painkiller for the heart, but it's also a sleep inducer. Like it calibrates your sleep patterns, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't understand that the brain has two parts. Everything has a heart. The heart of the brain is in the glands. That's why when you're reciting, you are taking care of the third eye.
Yeah.
A lot of people are disconnected from their third eye. Everything's sensual now. You know?
Yeah.
If you know about the MBTI, very few people are introspection. They're sensing.
Yeah.
Right? And that is dunya.
Materialistic world.
If you don't feed the heart,
mm-hmm.
By reciting the names of Allah and writing, because that is taking care of your neuroplasticity, right?
So it has got a mechanism for itself.
Sorry?
It has got a mechanism for itself. An entire mechanism of becoming a part of me. Something that I recite.
Yes,
all the
you have, because vibrations are temporary.
Yeah.
But what you write,
mm-hmm.
firstly, you're inspiring the nafs. You're inspiring the nafs.
There are many friends of mine that they do not practice hijab, but at the same time they're doing the recitation and they're being very well-mannered people. They treat other human beings so well, but still I see this paradoxical behavior that they do not practice what they have been raised upon, and they look at it in a different perspective.
Okay, because
and then
we're
you
analyzing
said
from performance.
Yeah, because we're analyzing.
Yeah,
from
performance. I have written a post about that very recently. How to understand superficial piety and real depth of piety. Because I write a lot of posts on my blogs. I have about 26 blogs.
Yeah.
And I give the name of it, in fact, because it will help a lot. I go scientifically, metaphysically. I approach it from MBTI, Myers-Briggs model. And I use every neuroplasticity, neurochemistry. All of these are on my blog.
Yeah.
So sadiqevolution.blogspot.com.
So everything has to be practiced with my heart and with my soul, with a link to God, so that it would manifest itself in my behavior as well as my acts. I guess this was the gist of the next part of today's episode. And that was a very deep and profound discussion, and I hope it would work many of us to add to our insights. Dear ladies, this was all for today. I hope you have enjoyed that. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning to you all. You are tuned in to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and we are very glad to have you with us. I'm your host for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with our radio productions feature. After that, we have Spotlight. This is a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. And we round up this hour's programs with Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. Stay with us.